ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Lynette Walworth is here today. Lynette is an artist and an award-winning filmmaker. Much of her work springs from an experience she had as a little girl in country New South Wales when she had a near-death experience. Lynette's spent much of her life trying to understand what happened that day when she returned from the very brink. She created paintings and artwork that tried to touch on what she saw and felt, and then she started visiting remote communities in Australia and then in the Amazon, where people traditionally take psychedelics like ayahuasca to experience something similar. Lynette's latest film is a powerful documentary. It's called Edge of Life, which investigates how doctors here in Australia are turning to psychedelics like psilocybin to help ease the path of terminally ill patients towards their death. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, Richard.
This experience I spoke of at the beginning happened when you were little, living with your folks in Orange in country New South Wales. What do you remember of that life as a little girl knocking about in the country?
Yeah, my dad was a bank manager, so we had to move. And we moved to Orange, which is a beautiful town. Traditionally, we would go to my grandparents' place in Tamworth for Christmas or Easter. So actually where this event happened was in my grandparents' backyard. Huge backyard, loved being there. I was only about 9 years old, playing on this drum, rolling on it, and then I fell, hit my back. And as had sometimes happened to me, I had a seizure and stopped breathing.
Were you prone to having seizures?
Yeah. They were not very common, but I had them on and off from age of two till this last seizure, which was the final one for me.
And what happened as you were having this seizure?
I recall looking at myself and being aware that I couldn't breathe. And then the next minute, I was no longer in that body. I was inside of light. I was moving through light, and there were colours that I'd never seen before, like a particularly in this sort of purple-violet range of colours. And then I came to a sort of boundary that you can't go any further beyond. And I can't tell you how long all of this took, this movement, this travel, and then coming to these beings who, it wasn't like they were people, but they were also full of light. And I realized that they were connected to me, though I didn't know who they were. Years later, I realized they were my grandmother's parents.
Why do you think that now?
I saw them in a photo. I'd known one, but I hadn't known the other. My great-grandfather, had died 6 days before I was born. And so all I knew was that these, and so it's strange to call them people, but let's say people, loved me. I felt so loved. It was like swimming in compassion.
Now, I have about 1,000 questions about this.
Yeah.
First of all, you said you had a sense of being outside of your body. Did you have a sense of being in another body? Could you look and
no.
see hands and legs? And so you were disembodied, disembodied. Next question is, when you were approaching this boundary, was it a boundary you could see, or was it an understanding you were reaching a boundary?
It's like an understanding, and there's no words, and this is what people who have near-death experience will traditionally say, how you know something and no one's speaking to you, but you come to know. So I knew I couldn't go any further. I understood I couldn't go any further. I understood, but somehow also understood I belonged here. I felt incredibly held.
So you weren't struck with holy terror like a UFO abduction or something
God.
Like that?
No, I mean, it's so strange. It's like you're fluid, you're not in your body anymore, you're free. You're connected to everything. So there was also a sensation of, I've heard someone describe like the individuality of a snowflake and then a bed of snow. So I'm myself, but I'm part of all of this. And I absolutely know that I'm me and I'm connected to me, but I also feel myself to be connected to everything that is. That's a big concept for a 9-year-old to hold.
Those beings that you now believe to have been your
grandparents.
Great-grandparents. Mm-hmm. Were they beckoning you or just watching you?
They were standing, greeting is probably the way that I would feel it, greeting almost like this, here comes this little person. She can't go any further than this, so we are here to at once welcome her but indicate to her she needs to go back.
In the really tacky movie that's made of this scene from your life, they're there, you recognise them, the great-grandma's wearing an apron,
and
they're talking to you and they're saying things, but it wasn't like that at all, was it?
No, they're not saying, and I can't say, so I don't know how I knew later who they were, because if I have to describe them to you, again, I can only describe them as light, like light-filled. I knew they were associated with me and I knew they were associated with the family lineage too. So somehow I understood that.
There's a lot of information flooding into your head then, is that right?
I also, can I say, because this was at my this was at my grandparents' house, I also knew somehow that the person of my family who would next be there to meet these people or this sort of lineage was my grandfather. And I understood somehow everyone will be greeted and he will be greeted next.
When it finished, did you have this sense of being sucked back into your body, like into a vacuum cleaner or something like that? Or was it more you woke up or was it a sudden transition? No, Can you recall?
The family had to come. I mean, people came looking for me and found me blue in the backyard and my poor dad had to resuscitate me. Horrible for a dad.
So you weren't just having a seizure. You were dying at this point. You had stopped breathing?
I had stopped breathing. Because they didn't know what my seizures were, I always stopped breathing. And I usually had an out-of-body experience. And so, but this time, obviously, there was no one around me. And I went very far and I stopped breathing for a longer time. My lips were blue. I was blue. I was not breathing. And he had to resuscitate me. And I can't imagine how terrifying that was for him. But I remember opening my eyes and coming back. And my thought was, this is a dream.
What, this world now we're in?
Yeah.
And what you were in was real?
That's what I thought.
You really thought that at the time?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a dream. That is enduring. This will pass, but we're dreaming all of this together.
See, I don't know if you're a fan of Lewis Carroll, but there's this marvellous moment in Through the Looking Glass where Alice runs into Tweedledee and Tweedledum and she's shouting at them and they say, shh, don't wake up the Red King. And they look at the Red King, the chess piece, it's asleep under the tree because we're all just part of his dream.
Yeah.
And if he wakes up, then we'll all go out like a candle. And she gets very upset. She goes, don't be ridiculous. I would go out. Yes, yes, you are. You're nothing but a thing in his dream. And she gets very angry. And, of course, the whole book is a dream. And when she wakes up, she says, I don't know if I was a girl dreaming of the Red King or if the Red King's dreaming about me. Mm. I'm putting this up because there's enormous commonalities from what you're telling me and research studies that have been done into people who have said they've had near-death experiences. There's a list of 11 common factors, and I think you just ticked off about, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them, I think. You couldn't have been aware of that, though, as a little girl, could you?
Raymond Moody's book on life after life, which terms the phrase near-death experience, comes out 5 years after this. So it wasn't talked about, it wasn't a term, it wasn't known, people who had the experiences knew, but there was no one I could talk to, there was no one in my world. I did tell a doctor, the doctor who did my brain scan, what had happened to me, and I worked out very quickly I should not say these things, because I told him everything that happened, probably in much more detail than I'm telling you, because it had just happened, and he said to me, oh, you had a dream, and I said, no, this is the dream. And then from his reaction and my mother's, I realised I should not say these things out loud.
Well, you're being like Alice, aren't you? You say, I am not a thing in your dream, Lynette. Yes.
Yeah. I've often thought the best way I can describe it is like everyone you know, your entire world, all your friends, all your family, are living their life on the surface of a lake. And all the buildings exist on the surface of a lake and everything is on the surface of the lake. And then one day I fell in and then I experienced myself in a different way. I was moving differently. I was breathing somehow without breathing. The colours are different. The way light is different. Everything is different. The beings there are different. And I'm seeing all of it and then someone pulls me out and I can never speak of it again.
Were you glad to be back? Or was it a bit like that thing when you go and see Star Wars as a kid? You're in this kind of amazing world. You're having an incredible time. But afterwards, you've got to walk out of the cinema into the main drag and there's cars and pollution and you've got to do your homework or whatever.
Yeah.
Was the real, well, what I'm calling the real world, yeah. was it a bit disappointing to be back?
You know, in that minute, I think probably it was hard to be back because that's an extraordinary sensation, and maybe the most extraordinary sensation is the feeling of this all-encompassing love, because how do we feel that? How do we feel that? But that was my sensation. I've often thought probably it's a little bit easier if you have a near-death experience when you're older and you're kind of, maybe you've formed a family, you've tethered yourself to this life. Those people want to come back because those connections they've built are drawing them back. They've made a family. They've got children. There's things that will pull you back. It's like a tether. I was young and I didn't have that. I had my own family, but I hadn't constructed my identity in the world yet and hadn't formed those connections myself.
So you're getting very, very powerfully the vibe from doctors and maybe your parents. I don't know. Don't talk about this. What, they didn't want you to look like a weirdo? Was that the idea?
I don't know how, if you had a child wanting to talk to you about that and you didn't understand it yourself, had never heard about it, it would seem very strange. I think 10 years later, people would have known about it. The term existed and maybe someone would have said, maybe take her to a counsellor or someone she can talk to. But that was not what happened in those days. And so it's probably, I think it's why I became an artist, Richard. I wrote a lot of poems then in those days. Actually, I wrote a poem in sixth class, probably not that long after this, which was about these big concepts of connectedness, right? My parents were dragged down to the nuns to ask who had written this poem because clearly it couldn't have been me. I copied someone else's poem because this could not have been my concept. But making artwork, of course, like it's a way of expressing things without saying them.
Did you lose your fear of death, given that you felt you approached what was the brink of life? Did you understand that to be the brink of life? And afterwards, did you think, well, it can't be that bad? I'm saying that as someone who remembers what Kerry Packer famously said when he was clinically dead and said, mate, I've looked over the other side and there's nothing there.
Sorry,
But you saw something different. Did that take the fear of death from you?
It's the most essential aspect of it. It's the most common aspect of a near-death experience. And I don't know if you'd ask me then, did I know that was death? I don't know. But fundamentally from that point on, no, I have never been afraid of death. And I didn't know that also was unusual until there'd be moments where I'd realise I'm around other people or friends where death is happening or where grief is happening, and I realise my reaction is unusual.
How so? In what way?
My comfort. I'm comfortable there. I'm comfortable around someone dying.
How about that sense of being untethered from this world? How would that crop up for you?
My friend Jen, she talks about walking to school with me because we lived like a block away from each other, and that I would duck my head down under branches that were way high above me.
Why?
Because I had a sense of myself, I think, always that there was a part of me that was existing from that perspective of being above my own body. I think because those seizures had happened several times and because that sensation is so distinct, there is a me who's existing in this body and also outside of this body.
In your film, when you have people talking about their psychedelic experiences as they're approaching death, so often they struggle to put it into words.
Yeah.
And you're telling me about it now, but I feel you're doing the very best you can. But as you're telling me this stuff, do you feel that it's easily escaping your attempt to bring it into language?
You know, it's like we don't have the words for it.
And when we do, it's kind of tacky, isn't it? It becomes new agey.
And that's why I think I do the work I do, because all that I know is that I can't say it, but I might be able to give you an experience of it. So I'm hoping for you to experience something for yourself, a sensation of, look, it's why I worked in immersive artworks for so long, where people would have to go into a space and feel something and experience something and touch something and things would happen for them, virtual reality or installations that activated with your presence. I am conscious that I can't say these things, but I could try and help you experience them.
Your documentaries, your films have won awards. You won an Emmy Award.
Two Emmys.
I beg your pardon. I got late mail on that. Okay, two Emmys. And you've had virtual reality installations at places like the World Economic Forum, where some of these powerful CEOs have sat in beanbags and been confronted by your work.
I've been lucky enough to take that work to places where the decision makers are, and that's been very important to me, and to give them experiences that they might not otherwise ever have.
Some years ago, you were invited to meet with remote Aboriginal communities in South Australia and Western Australia. Tell me about where that took you and the kind of people you met there.
I travelled to the Oak Valley community, the closest community to where Britain tested atomic bombs in the South Australian desert.
Oh, Maralinga, around there. Yeah. Right.
So I went to Maralinga and then stayed one night there. And then I went onward and met with the community. And the benefit for me of meeting remote Aboriginal communities is I finally felt the way I think about the world is very normal here.
What, you hadn't thought that up until this
point? No, I think culturally I was unusual and I had learnt to be very careful about things that I said or thought, especially around death. I think I felt sometimes my relationship to death was, I knew what I had seen was real.
And did you think if you went out to these communities, they might have a different cultural tradition about that?
I didn't think that. I was just so happily shown that.
How? How did they show you that? Can you talk about that?
That's another thing. Some things I can talk about. With the Madu, for example, when I talked to them about my experience, they told me if I had been a child with those experiences in that community, they would have trained me. So there are trainings that they could do to help someone with that tendency to leave the body, come back to the body, leave the body, to come back to the body, to travel, which, as I understood it, this is my very, very, very minor understanding of it, meant that I could extend that capacity, I could learn from it, and I could use it in ways that would be helpful for the community. I was like a person this had happened to who had no training, no one I could even talk to about it.
Did they see it as a kind of a... Is gift the right word, or is it more like just a thing that happens to people?
It's something familiar. They can also travel together in ceremony out of their bodies. So they told me about a song that they used to use when they were brought into a mission. These are people, the Madu, whose first contact was in the 1960s. And when they were brought into a mission and missing home, one of the men created a song that allowed them to travel. They said, as if on a shooting star, back across the country so they could see it when they were missing it. They had practices that were real to them, that were not strange and that were common.
At some point you met a shaman from the Amazon basin. How did you come to meet this man,
Lynette? Oh, Tashka. So he's a chief. I met him at Oxford in England.
Oxford? Of course. God, you can't walk for 5 minutes in Oxford without running to an Amazonian shaman, can you? Oxford, why Oxford? What was he doing there?
So Jeff Skoll, you know, of eBay, he's started something called the Skoll World Forum. And I had a long-standing relationship with the Sundance Institute. And so Sundance took a group of filmmakers traditionally to this forum so we could meet a lot of the social entrepreneurs that Jeff Skoll's forum was supporting. And so the first year I went, I met a group of chiefs from the Amazon, and one of them was Tashka Yawanawa, and we became friends.
What did he tell you about how his people approached the end of life and experiences like the one you had when you were little?
He tested a virtual reality work that I had at the Skoll World Forum. He took off the headset and he said, okay, we can work with this technology. It acts as a portal. So you think about someone wearing a headset. It acts as a portal. Sound and colour is intensified. You travel. You meet the elders. Then you return to your reality. We can use this. My friend, you're going to have to come to the Amazon. That was his first request to me. So already he was looking at the technology I was using as a technology that was not as good as traveling in an ayahuasca vision, but in which a story of the Yawanawa could be translated into Western culture.
That's his people, the Yawanawa.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot, therefore, about all of this, about leaving the body, about visioning, and about end of life. And he said really clearly, Yawanawa are sad when someone dies, but we don't fear death. Traditionally, what many elders will do, even now there, is they anticipate death is coming and they'll call all the family members to them because they want to give their last messages. So for them, the most important thing is to embrace that death is coming and to prepare everyone and to gift them with the knowledge that you want them to carry onward.
I'm sure that's hard, whether you have access to this cultural tradition or not. Is it still a hard thing to do, though, rather than just to simply accept it? Or is it something you just can't help but accept?
I know. I think it's hard for family, I think, because there's grief and there's loss and we miss people. And the letting go of life is hard. We know it's hard. We love this. We love life. We love people in our lives. And you heard this during COVID so much. There were people dying and they were afraid. And not only that, then during COVID, they were alone and afraid. I heard and read too many stories of people being in isolation and dying and looking into a void of unknowing.
So Tushka, the shaman invited you to come out and meet his community. What did that mean? What does it mean to go out to somewhere in the Amazon basin? Where was his community?
A lot of preparation.
A lot of preparation.
They're in Acre, Brazil. So I was in LA, then we flew to Peru and then inward. And then you get on a smaller plane and then a smaller plane. And then you get on a truck and then you travel on the road and then you get in a canoe and then you travel for a day on the canoe. It's an adventure. And I'm terrified of spiders. I was worried about a lot of things, but oh my goodness, it was just the most extraordinary experience.
When you arrived there, what role did the shaman have among his own people? Was he like a priest or a doctor or a mayor or all of those things?
Well, Tushka's like a chief. So there were three shamans who were the shamans of the community that I went to, which is called Mutum. One was a woman shaman, Hushahu, who's the first woman that the Yawanawa trained to become a shaman, which was the story they wanted to tell. And two other shamans, a younger shaman, Kudarasu, who was connected to the lineage of the oldest shaman of the Yawanawa, and then Matsini, another shaman. And I was taken to a very sort of formal gathering, and one of these shamans stood up in front of me and told me, certain people, allies, would be allowed through to meet with them. And those allies would carry stories of the Yawanawa back out into the Western world in order that the Yawanawa themselves did not have to leave their homeland. So I was told everything I was there to do would work, everything would be okay, things would all go well, because this was part of this very big, very old story that I was now being sort of stitched into.
They traditionally brew a tea, a kind of a tea from the ayahuasca plant, which induces psychedelic visions. Do they use that to help people become less fearful of death? Is that something they give to people who are dying?
No.
Or no, it's not used for that purpose?
No, and I talked to Mukha about that. Mukha is the shaman in Edge of Life, the film. No, they wouldn't. And I can understand that they wouldn't need to. The story which Mukha relates about the origins of ayahuasca and why they first started using it, interestingly, is about death. So it's about the first death. So in that story, what they say is that Yawanawa peoples had not encountered death before. And then a chief, a beloved chief called Rua, dies. But they do not understand what death is because they have never known this state. What do we do with something? It's like they think he's become dormant. He's dormant. So they think, what do we do? So with a seed that is dormant, we would put it in the ground. So they plant him, they place him in the ground. We might today call that a burial. And from his body grows the vine that is used to make the ayahuasca drink, which is why some people call it the vine of the dead. And the Yawanawa work out that this vine, which they can make this drink from, is connected to Rua. And so they first drink it because they're full of grief and missing him and they want to die. Their grief makes them want to die. And they take the drink in order to die. But they don't die. Instead, they travel in a vision state out of their bodies and they meet him again.
Oh, so it's for the grieving,
yeah,
not for the terminally ill.
Yeah.
Lynette, in your film, you follow two doctors in Melbourne who are working in palliative care, Margaret and Justin. Tell me about the work they were doing when you started making the film.
So we first met during COVID and we did an earlier work together, which was to try and bring people who couldn't see their loved ones close to one another. We developed a virtual reality kit that people would take home, place the camera in the seat that that person usually sat in with their dog at their feet and maybe their loved one reading them a book beside them. And family would film that and then we would upload that directly into the headset that the person isolated in the hospital was now wearing. So then they were back at home and they were with their loved ones. And their loved ones could speak with them that way.
So we're talking about people who are dying in hospital and they can wear some kind of virtual reality headset and puts them back in their own home with the people that they can't be with.
Yeah, during COVID.
So what were they doing when you were encountering them at the start of this film?
So I read about this trial. I contacted Mark. I wrote to her. But as did like so many people, they were overwhelmed with people wanting to talk to her. But I thought, I think I can help because I have this use of these technologies that can help you travel in these states that might help your patients after they've done their trial.
Now, this research into using psilocybin and other psychedelics to help terminally ill patients become accepting of their death or be at peace with the idea of their death. It's been going on for a while in the United States. I've talked to science journalists in the United States about this who are reporting extraordinary results from people who find themselves much, much more at peace about the prospect of their imminent death. They're trialling this in Melbourne.
I think worldwide it was the first one that included a raft of people who didn't necessarily have cancer. They had all different sorts of conditions. All of them had a terminal diagnosis. So there's this pause that happens. They're going to have 35 patients, each with two experiences. One of those will be active psilocybin. Two might be because it's a closed trial where you don't know what's going to happen when you go in. So St. Vincent's Melbourne agreed that I could film one patient. And I knew Justin and Mark quite well by this point. Went to Melbourne. So we rock up to St. Vincent's where Justin and Marg are preparing this patient that we're going to film. Flavia arrives. Flavia's Brazilian by chance, and she's very young, only about 35 years old. She's having her first psilocybin experience.
And she has breast cancer.
Yeah, and her treatments are not working, and she's a very young husband, and she wanted to do the psilocybin experience because she was, trying to grapple with some deep, deep fears. But she also wanted it to be filmed because she thought there's something useful that could be conveyed. I mean, this is the amazing thing about the people in this film, Richard. You've got limited time. You've got hardly any time and you decide with that limited time, I'm going to let this filmmakers film me.
And what did she tell you after she finished the experience taking psilocybin in this doctor's room with a mask on her eyes and music in her ears? What did she say the experience had been like for her?
There was one moment when she was, it's a thing that's very difficult to say. What she wanted to be at peace with is that everyone she loved would be okay.
They won't be okay. They're going to leave the world and leave them behind and they'll grieve and won't be okay.
They'll be sad, but will their lives go on happily? That's obviously a deep need and I think it was Flavia's need and I think she got a sense of that in her experience.
Maybe we don't appreciate when people are in that situation where they're dying, that they sometimes feel guilt that they're leaving the world and leaving behind people racked with grief and missing them so much.
She said to me on that day, death is easier for me. And that's a big statement. She was very, very aware for her. So some part of her knew, she had a belief that this, that death was not the end of her consciousness.
Did she arrive at that after she'd taken the psilocybin?
No, I think she had the belief already. She just, I think, knew that the psilocybin might help her experience that in a more tangible way.
And did it?
I think it did. But she didn't talk to me much about that. She was to come back for her second experience 6 weeks later. We talked in between, she and I, on the phone. She expressed the fact that after her psilocybin experience, she wanted to meet with some of the people I knew, Indigenous shamans. I was trying to line that up, and very suddenly, Flavia died.
Another one of the patients was a woman called Roz, who was much more elderly, mm-hmm. who was a very wise woman and a Christian as well. She reports in your movie that the psilocybin was wonderful for her, and she found it quite easily meshed with her sincere Christian beliefs as well, didn't she?
Yeah. I don't think that's surprising. I think anyone with a deep spirituality understands what that feeling of mysticism is. And Roz was part of a contemplative community, so she spent a lot of time in prayer. And Roz's husband had died 2 years before her diagnosis. So she's got three young adult children, and their dad dies, her husband dies. And 2 years after that, she gets a diagnosis, a terminal diagnosis. So she's struggled with this diagnosis for some years with a lot of grief because she says she's going to leave these three young adults with no parents, and she's terrified. Roz cried a lot. But she's still doing her practices and she's, you know, trying to hold on to, I guess, a state of hopefulness. And then she has this psilocybin experience. In the psilocybin experience, how similar is it to mine? She says, I was lying there, then I was out of my body. I could see my body. She sees, first of all, her family, the kids who were still here. So she sees them in some almost future place. She sees that they are all okay. They're doing very ordinary things. Her daughter is putting food in containers. But she sees these three kids are all okay. And the moment she has the thought, they're okay, she's moving through light again. And she sees someone coming towards her who she knows and she recognizes. And it's her deceased husband.
Did he say anything to her in this vision?
He kissed her, and I don't know what he said, and I don't know if she would tell me what he said, but what she felt was an incredible sense of relief. She realizes he's okay. He kisses her. She understands this is death, and she returns.
So these two doctors, one is the psychiatrist, Justin, and the psychologist,
yes.
Micah, are doing this work, and they're struggling to comprehend the magnitude of what they're encountering. You offered to take them to the Amazon.
I mean, especially Justin. Justin in particular had said, you know, had no belief system that exists. He didn't want to talk about spirituality. Every time I would ask him a question that would veer in that direction, he would like, give me a look. I don't want to go there.
Right, this will get me kicked out of the science club, that kind of thing.
don't go in that. I'm not interested in that direction. But their patients were telling them things which they could quite clearly say, we have no reference point for this. Not only that, we have no language for it. We don't know how to talk about it. So how do we talk to our patients, as Mark says, about this? And I said, well, I have friends who use similar medicines to this. And if you wanted to, I could ask if you can go and visit, because I thought they'll show you.
So we see them both going to the Amazon basin, to the same place, and meeting another shaman who gets them to take part in an ayahuasca ceremony. At the end of it, Justin, the psychiatrist, is so overcome by what he's experienced, this enormously powerful vision he's had, he really can't find words to describe. The language just won't wrap around it. Again, we're in this place where language fails. There's a kind of a realization that The language of science can't tread into all areas of human existence. No. It just can't. It can't talk about the arts very well at all, or humour, or consciousness, or all those things. It always sounds very lumpy in those situations. It seems like that's the first time you might have thought of that, that there are places you can go to the words of science don't yet have language for.
Yeah, he had to have the experience. It's not like he hadn't heard these things from his patients. He hadn't experienced it.
He was upset by it. He said, I've got a stone in my shoe now. Yeah. Why was he upset about it?
Look, I can understand that a near-death experience shifts your whole worldview. So for me, I would use words like it extends your understanding of what reality is. And you can live with that. For me, when I was young, that was a gift, but it was an isolating gift and it was hard to live with. For Justin, who's come through this line of a form of science that is saying most of these kind of areas that we're dealing with are to do with things in our own mind, in our own brain, our own psyche, and then you experience something that has got nothing to do with that, but you experience it. Not only that, the thing that was most challenging for him is that Mukka, the shaman who was with him, Mukka could see where he was and communicate with him in his vision state. And so for Justin, that's like, how can that happen?
You mean Mukka, the shaman, while Justin was having this ayahuasca vision, Justin said he was able to walk into that vision?
Yeah, he says that. This thing about the level of knowledge of using these medicines.
There's a deal that's struck between Mukka, the shaman, and the doctors. And you see this happens when Mukka, I think it's Mukka, gets a gash on his leg, and the doctors who are trained in medicine are able to treat it using Western medical science. And he's got a lot of respect for that. And he said, yeah, we need emergency doctors out here. We need emergency medical practice out here. I've given you this. Now, can you get some people to train our people in emergency medicine? He's a very serious person who sees this transaction as being necessary for his own people.
And you see, he uses the word allies. So I said to Justin, the fact that that person's leg was cut open while you were there, that's no accident. You saw it because you were meant to see it and do something about it. So now we have to try and do something about this. And so when Mukka comes to Melbourne to spend some time with Justin and Marg, he does a training in emergency first aid and carries back with him some first aid kits for remote communities. When he came to Adelaide in October for the premiere, we gave him two more. And in 2 days' time, I'm having a conversation with an emergency care doctor who wants to help, and we're having a call with Tushka and Mukka in 2 days to talk about what they need and how we can keep supporting what is needed.
The world you're walking through at the moment, you know, your experience is incredibly sincere, and same with these doctors, and certainly same with Mukka, the shaman. But it's also a realm that attracts a lot of charlatans and fakers, and I wonder how you feel about all that. And are you constantly trying to protect yourself from influences, fake shamans, charlatans?
Yeah, I don't have a lot to do with my relationship.
Not always easy to see coming, though.
No, my relationships are with these, and I'm going to say really remote communities, and both with the Madu and the Yawanawa, they're lifelong relationships. Part of this conundrum, right, is we've got Western science and a Western philosophy which is largely materialistic.
And powerful.
And powerful, and it's constructed our worldview. But we're moving into some levels of science. Again, we don't have the word for it, but I believe we need this. This is not new knowledge. This is lost knowledge. I think we can retrieve it. I think we can pull it back in. I think even that someone like me at my age can now talk about this is because we can see where the edges of our belief system have contained us and where it's left us with a void that harms and hurts. And I am of the thinking that a direct experience of the mystical is a human right. And I don't understand why it's been removed from so much of Western culture. But I do think we can attain it.
This journey you've been on began with this near-death experience you had as a little girl. When you were in the Amazon, did you take ayahuasca?
Yeah.
And did that take you to a similar place or somewhere completely different?
It was different. It was very different for me because it was all about my senses. So that was so interesting, hearing things that I couldn't normally hear. Seeing colours similarly, but I didn't travel. I was very physically in the forest. I did see two birds that whenever I looked up, I saw these two. I thought they were vultures. Now I would say condors. But I was terrified to tell my friends that I was seeing these vultures everywhere, because I'm from this world and my only interpretation of a vulture was to do with death, but not a great image of death, you know, a bird that is picking on bones. So clearly it wasn't this joyful experience for me because I couldn't interpret it. So for days I didn't tell anyone, days. And then after a few days, because it was gnawing at me, I told Tushka's wife, Laura, and I said, you know, I saw these colours, but also I saw vultures. And she said, oh, that's shamans. They're shamans watching you. And so I needed to understand it from her perspective. I couldn't interpret it.
What you encountered in that ayahuasca vision, did that change you in any way, or are you already changed?
It didn't change me, Richard. I think, to be honest, the reason Tushka invited me there, I think that cultures that have kept this channel of understanding and knowledge alive can recognize this tendency towards an altered state that exists in someone else. It's probably like a spectrum. If I was to show you a spectrum, oh, here's this person, and that spectrum is alive in them. I think that they can detect it. And so that is one reason why I could be of use.
I've heard evolutionary biologists talk about near-death experiences. They accept that people have gone through them, of course, because there are just so many accounts that completely, yeah, you can't ignore them. But there's a view, I think, that says that these near-death experiences are these helpful hallucinations that help us, our bodies do for ourselves and create for ourselves, just to help us get out of our own skin in the end, to make our own death less painful and traumatic to us. But they don't imply another world, an afterlife. Do you have a view on all that, whether there is an afterlife, or are you more inclined to think this is a beautiful spiritual hallucination?
No. I mean, on that spectrum they ask, where you would ask someone who's had a near-death experience, between this point of dream and more real than real, it is more real than real. That's what people will tick over and over again.
More real than real.
Yeah, and for me that's what it was. So, which is why when I could return to my reality, it felt like a dream. So something is so tangible in that state. And I'm going to say it's like you've woken up. It's like you've woken up to something that you then cannot fall asleep to again.
So when people describe this as being like a dream or a vision, it's not like that at all then.
They don't know, because we don't have the words for it, no. I know my consciousness goes on. I know what I experienced was real. I've never been able to doubt it. I'm many decades past it and it's never faded. I believe there's many people have had a similar experience, and I think it's in the traditions of many religions, although it may be described in a different way, the understanding that consciousness goes on and that there is, the Madhu would say, the body is a companion we walk this life with. The physical dies, but something still exists beyond that is what my experience was.
My mum was a geriatric nurse for many years, and I think this is an example of somehow these folk traditions or this folk knowledge kind of endures nonetheless. She's brought up in the church, but nonetheless, I used to ask her as a teenager, Mum, how do you sit with people who are dying? She said, oh, it's not so bad. She says, you hold the hand, you tell them to move towards the light, and they'll see everyone they love there. I went, what? I was like, my God, Mum, how do you know to do that kind of thing? I've seen people just seem to know how to do that. There's kind of a knowledge they've already had, or it's been handed down or something. And Mum couldn't say where she'd got it from, but she just knew what to say, and it was of comfort to people who were dying. So those folk traditions have endured. They're still there, or they maybe are still there. But that thought about how one approaches the end of life, to walk towards the light, the field of lights, the loved ones that are there, has been an enduring thing.
To surrender to, but without fear, right? So that's our challenge. That's our challenge, to be comfortable enough to know that something exists beyond. You can't prove that. I can tell you my experience, and I'm telling you my experience. And, you know, maybe in 25 years there'll be forms of science that can affirm some of what we're saying. I think that's emerging more now. But I've never been shaken from my understanding that the physical is one thing, and there's part of me that that exists beyond that and will.
When that shaman from the Amazon, Munka, comes to Melbourne, he meets with the grieving husband, who's the husband of Flavia, who's died, and he's been living with grief for too long and he can't get past it, and that's really, really troubled him.
Yeah.
And the shaman says the most extraordinary thing to him. It's very beautiful and very wise about how to see his grief. And he says this amazing thing to him. He says, "We didn't come to Earth to run around in fear." What do you think of that?
I mean, I myself personally, Richard, have always thought I'm not very good at life.
Why?
But I've just always thought it. I think possibly, I know I'm comfortable in this place between life and death. I don't know that I'm great at living life.
Are you a tourist in this world? Is that what you mean?
I think I'm less tethered here, but I've not that I've had an extraordinary life. I have beautiful friendships. But the state that Mukha's talking about, like he says to Chris, she's given you a staff and you need to hold to that. And as in, that's what Flavia's told you. We didn't come here to run around and be afraid. We have to live. And he's saying the wholeness of life. And you can see how embodied Mukha is, like how physical he is, how extraordinary he is. He's living.
We didn't come to Earth to run around in fear. Just finally, though, Lynette, you mentioned that when you returned from your near-death experience, you had a sense that that was real and the world you returned to was a dream. In all honesty, have you ever lost that? Am I a thing in your dream? No. Are you the Red King? And if you were to wake up, I'd go out like a candle. Am I a thing in your dream?
No. We're in each other's dream, Richard. We're in each other's dream. We know each other within the confines of what is knowable, but there is much more beyond that. And these experiences that open a portal to that, they are so worth it. And you and I, in that portal, also exist.
It's been fascinating speaking with you, Lynette. It's amazing to talk about these things that for which there are no real words.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Lynette Walworth's latest film is called Edge of Life.
Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Today's conversation with Lynette Walworth was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.